Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang, and this is episode number 256.
Two games open.
As part of our Art of Living interview series, our guest today on the Not Old Better Show is Raymond Arsenault. Raymond Arsenault is the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. He is one of the nation's leading civil rights historians. He is the author of several acclaimed and prize-winning books, including the book we'll be talking about today, Arthur Ashe, A Life. The book is wonderful, and we'll add an excerpt reading by actor Dishon Terry, courtesy of Simon Schuster, at the very end of this interview. But first, my quick review of the book, and then our conversation with author Raymond Arsenault. I played tennis as a boy, my wife still plays, and my son has played competitive tennis his entire life. The Not Old Better audience will recall the talented, graceful, intelligent tennis star Arthur Ashe. Arthur Ashe was a childhood hero of mine, as was skier Jean Coquille. I've always been an individual sport guy, and Arthur Ashe played the best tennis of my era, at a time when tennis wasn't as integrated as it is today. But, as with so many areas of his life, Arthur Ashe transcended sport in general and specifically tennis. He had a positive impact on virtually every part of the world he touched by adhering to a stringent code of personal ethics, an extraordinary work ethic, and a deep commitment to social and civic responsibility. Ashe was a man of integrity, dignity, and athletic ability. A role model? Yes. A leader? Yes. A man whose life ended too soon? Yes. That's why this biography, which is so well researched by our guest today, Raymond Arsenault, is so excellent. On the eve of the 50th anniversary of the great Arthur Ashe becoming the first African-American man to win the U.S. Open, we learn and remember this great man, the first comprehensive authoritative biography of American icon Arthur Ashe, the Jackie Robinson of men's tennis, a pioneering athlete who, after breaking the color barrier, went on to become an influential civil rights activist and public intellectual. I love the book. Please join me in welcoming its author, the Arthur Ashe biographer, Raymond Arsenault. Ray Arsenault, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
And I'm so happy to talk to you. The timing for your book is really just ideal. I have been watching the U.S. Open along with my wife. We've been enjoying it. I know it's been hot there. I know you've been there. But we're talking today about your book, Arthur Ashe, and the new book, Ashe, A Life. And I wonder if you can tell us, why Ashe? Why now?
Well, originally, wasn't supposed to be now. It took me 9 years to complete the book, and I didn't anticipate it would be quite such a long project. But in some senses, it was probably fortuitous because it has come out just in time for the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Open and the 50th anniversary of Arthur Ashe winning the first U.S. Open in 1968. And to add to that, he would have turned 75 this July, and it's been 25 years since his death in February of 1993. So it's kind of a perfect storm of commemoration, and so I'm pleased that there's been so much attention given to Arthur and to the book over the last couple of weeks. I mean, I have been a great admirer of his since I was in graduate school. My close friend and tennis partner in graduate school introduced me to the cult of Arthur Ashe. He was a professor at George Washington University later, Jim Horton, and he looked like Arthur's twin, same height, same weight, same coloration, same topspin backhand, and so that's how I really got involved, although my interest has been in him as a tennis player, but much more as an activist, as a public intellectual, what he did off the court. Of course, it was based on his fame on the court, it gave him a platform, but I think he valued the work that he did and the other aspects of his life more than his any victories he might win. He might win on the court. So I've always been interested in the connection between race and sports, in particular, the kind of romantic racialism with which black athletes have been treated. The way I see it, you know, the formal codified segregation system of Jim Crow collapsed in the 1960s. That was the good news, but the bad news is that many blacks were put into this sort of cultural box where they were treated as entertainers, as natural athletes, as that's what they were put on the earth to do, and they really weren't valued, I think, as intellectuals or doctors or lawyers or professors or engineers or whatever. The recruiters came into the inner city to see if they could, you know, throw a football or dribble a basketball, and I think that was really unfortunate, the kind of romantic racialism which stereotyped them. And what I was interested in with respect to Ash and with some other figures, notably Bill Russell in the NBA and Frank Robinson in Major League Baseball, because they were the first two coaches. And, of course, Arthur was the first black captain of the Davis Cup team, that these were athletes who you couldn't stereotype them in the notion that they were just providing brawn and not brains. They were articulate. They were they spoke out, and they were leaders. And so I think that was my early interest in Ash, was as one of those figures. I even thought about doing a collective biography on Bill Russell, Frank Robinson, and Arthur Ashe, but I finally realized that Ashe was certainly deserving of his own full comprehensive biography, something amazingly that no one had done before.
Yeah, I have to say I just thoroughly enjoyed it. The timing is perfect, as I say. The book is wonderful. It's so well researched. And you mentioned the 9 years that you spent working on it. The index, the notes, the statistics are almost a book unto themselves. I've got the book here in my hands as we're talking, and it is a massive amount of research that you've done to bring Arthur Ashe to life again for us. What did you learn about him that was eye-opening in terms of, because we know so much about his sport legacy and legend, but as a human rights activist, as a businessman, as a celebrity, what was the most enlightening thing that you found about Arthur Ashe?
Well, I learned so much. I think I thought I knew him when I began this project, but I really didn't. I guess the biggest surprise was that he was I shouldn't have been surprised, but that he's a very complex character, in the sense that on the outside he was famously cool and calm, deliberate, non-emotional, and that was his signature kind of personal style. But on the inside, I think he was quite driven. It was a lot of tumult in there because he took the weight of the world on his shoulders. Early on in his life, until he was about 24, 25, he was like most young athletes. He was pretty self-absorbed, and in particular, since he was the only black playing on the tennis tour, he had to be really careful. He felt vulnerable. His coaches, of course, told him, you know, never make a fuss. If a white boy hits the ball and it's just out, but he thinks it's in, you call it in. Sort of the way that Branch Rickey counseled Jackie Robinson in the early years and when he broke the color line in Major League Baseball. So Ash had a lot to keep inside of himself. And I think he also felt a great deal of guilt, you know, while he was stroking a tennis ball in these country clubs. And even though he suffered a certain amount of discrimination at those clubs, you know, he knew that other young black boys and girls were, you know, braving the fire hoses and the attack dogs in Birmingham, and they were putting their bodies on the line. And as he later said, he said, as my fame increased, so did my anguish. And I think that's part of what drove him, was trying to make up for lost time. That beginning in 1968, he was deeply moved, shocked really, by the assassinations of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. He actually saw Bobby Kennedy just 2 days before he was assassinated. And I think that something happened. He just turned towards activism and never looked back. You know, he finally decided he had to speak out. And it actually began in March of 1968 when he gave a speech in a church in Washington. Actually, Stokely Carmichael was in the audience, and he was talking about the responsibility of black athletes to give back to the black community. And he was in the Army, actually, at the time, and was on leave from West Point. And he said some pretty controversial things that day, and his superior officers at West Point didn't like it very much, and he got a slap back. But that didn't stop him. He was more determined than ever. And so for the last 25 years of his life, he did everything that he could to fight for equality and social justice and to make the world a better place. And he was so driven. He kept saying, you know, the championships that I win on the court, they don't really mean that much. I mean, I want to win. I've had a great life, fame and fortune and all that, but that's not what really drives me. That's not what really will mean anything in the end. And he kept counseling other athletes to become activists, to speak out, to be truth tellers. And I think today, if he were here, he'd only be 75. You know, same age as Joe Biden, he'd still be in the thick of things. He would he'd be taking a knee for social justice. I think he would appreciate the fact that Colin Kaepernick and LeBron James and Stephen Curry have not allowed really President Trump to bring them down into the gutter with him. You know, that they've been non-emotional and respectful and have not engaged in the Twitter wars and the name calling and the bullying. And I think in that sense, that's what they're acting for the most part in the tradition of Arthur Ashe, who was always very calm and deliberative on the outside and as good a listener as he was a talker. And always looking for, you know, more information. And so in that sense, he almost alone among professional athletes. You might put Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the same category and maybe James Blake. But he was a public intellectual, you know, very well read, always asking the tough questions, corresponding with scholars and other, you know, people who were interested in public affairs. He was compulsive about doing the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. He collected first editions. You know, he wrote a 3-volume history of black athletes. For many years, he wrote a column for the Washington Post and wrote op-ed pieces for the New York Times and other newspapers. And it's astonishing that he even had time to play tennis. And I think actually, if he had been more single-minded, if he'd been a Bjorn Borg, for example, he probably would have won more tournaments. So he did win 51, and he won 5 majors, you know, 2 doubles titles and 3 singles titles, and of course the great victory at Wimbledon in 1975 and the Australian Open in 1970, in addition to the first U.S. Open title in 1968. And he was number one in the world at one point and number one in the United States for several years, and so he was a great player, but his mind was never always on the court. He was also, of course, deeply involved in the development of open tennis as the president of the Association of Tennis Professionals, and he was very intimately involved in such things as bringing tennis back to the Olympics in the 1980s and fighting for the rights of players, you know, in a kind of a labor union sense. And he was just everywhere. I don't know how he did it, frankly. It was exhausting just watching him. As I was doing my research, I was just kept marveling at. I can't really believe that. You know, you look at his daily log book, and he would be in 3 different cities in any given day. You know, he'd be flying to Miami for a workshop for inner city kids, or sharing some sort of benefit in New York, and then flying to Los Angeles. Board meetings, you know, he was on the board of Aetna Insurance, and he, of course, did endorsements for Head Rackets and for Catalina Sportswear, and, you know, he was on every board you can imagine, and, you know, whenever they wanted someone to MC a banquet for some important person in the tennis world, they often looked to to Arthur. And, you know, he was worked for the Heart Association. And, of course, after he contracted AIDS, for the last 10 months of his life after it became public, he pretty much all he did was AIDS awareness and creating a foundation for the defeat of AIDS, which is still going on, by the way. I mean, he left an unbelievable legacy, really. I don't know if there's anybody else quite like him in the modern history of sports. And, of course, a number of his protégés, some of the younger black players and white players too, have taken him as a model. It's remarkable to see the number of foundations that have been created by people like Laurie McNeil and Katrina Adams and Leslie Allen and just on and on and on, Mal Washington, and so many of the people who were associated with him are continuing to do his work.
He certainly was an impressive man. And you mention Colin Kaepernick, and you were at the U.S. Open last week, and Colin Kaepernick was shown on, as my wife and I watched the Open, Colin Kaepernick was shown in the stands and received a huge ovation. Serena.
You know, I heard about that. I was in another venue, and so I didn't actually see it, and I read about it afterwards and heard about it, of course. And it's very, very gratified to hear that that had taken place.
Yeah, we were as well. My wife and I were as well. We just noticed that Ash, the of course Serena and Venus were playing in Ash Stadium, and that wasn't lost on us. That was a moment, I think, and you can tell that Ash has had that kind of influence on players today, and Serena even took active notice and was vocal about her support of Colin Kaepernick. So this seems to be a legacy with Ash. Do you think that's what he wanted, or do you think he was so in the moment that it was all about the time, or did he have a sense as to his legacy?
I don't think he had a sense, because he died so young at 49, and a lot of the full appreciation came when people began to think about how he dealt with AIDS in such a dignified and courageous manner that put him into a whole different category. I mean, he was already the most admired person in tennis, along with Billie Jean King, I would say. I think he'd be shocked that there's a stadium named for him, and he'd be shocked about the statues. Although the statue in Richmond, of course, was going to be in front of an African American sports Hall of Fame that he was promoting to come to Richmond. It was never built, and after his death, Doug Wilder, who was an old friend of Arthur's, governor, mm-hmm. black governor of Virginia, took the lead to put it on Monument Avenue to sort of to change the legacy of Richmond from not just Civil War, you know, gallant brigadiers and generals, but to its civil rights heritage. And I think it was a major event to put it on Monument Avenue, even though Arthur's widow, Jeannie Matusmi Ash, has never really reconciled it to it. There was so much consternation about it. I think she felt they didn't deserve Arthur to be there. But I think my view is that it is a good, it's a great thing. I've been there many times to see people coming up and taking photographs and making a kind of a pilgrimage to the sculpture on Monument Avenue. But back to the notion of the legacy, I think he was very conscious of having a legacy. But not the normal kind that you think of, sort of fame and fortune, or things, you know, that he put his name on or anything to keep him famous. In fact, he said very much he didn't care about those things at all. What he cared about is creating something out of the athletic world that would transcend sports. That people like him would use their celebrity for the greater good, not just for themselves. And he felt that so deeply, I think, and tried to be a model for that. And I think in that sense, he really has been very successful. Think about the ESPN giving the annual, you know, Arthur Ashe Courage Award. And there's several other organizations that give an annual Arthur Ashe Award. And I think he'd probably be surprised that these things have persisted. Because he knew, you know, how sort of fickle popular culture can be, And one moment's hero is next moment's, you know, sort of also ran. But I think he's a great exception to that. I think I'm hopeful that my book will, in some way, you know, encourage the new generations to rediscover Arthur Ashe. I've found that although most people know his name, in part because of the stadium, that they don't really know the layers of his life. And they just know he was famous, not quite sure who he was. And I hope that'll change, because I think it's such an empowering story of how he, you know, grew up in the kind of Jim Crow streets of Richmond from a very kind of working class family, and you know, thought of as a second class citizen, cradle to grave segregation, never allowed to play whites when he was growing up, forced to leave the city actually his senior year to go to St. Louis to live with a high school tennis coach that helped him to, you know, play with a broader range of players, both black and white, and that really set the stage for him going to UCLA and winning the U.S. Junior Indoor title that year in 1960, and kind of opened kind of a gateway for him. It opened up, I think, the whole world. And going to California, you kind of followed in the traditions of Jackie Robinson and others at UCLA, Rafer Johnson, many great black athletes. And California didn't turn out to be quite the racial nirvana that he had expected, but certainly gave him the kind of breathing room and social space to eventually turn himself into what he called a citizen of the world. So he begins in a kind of a very parochial background, but I think in part because of his inquisitive mind and his love of reading, and he just took advantage of every opportunity to sort of expand his interests and truly become a citizen of the world.
Ray Arsenault, author of the new book, Arthur Ashe, A Life. We so appreciate your time today. I know you're very busy. I just have one last question / comment. I wonder if you'd talk about the pictures. I really encourage my audience to go out and buy this book. Literally get it in your hands, because the book is wonderful. The research is thorough and complete. This is a complex man of great dignity, integrity, athletic ability. But the photos that you've shared in the book are wonderful. I'll tell you my favorite, and then maybe tell me yours, Raymond Arsenault. My favorite is of Arthur Ashe and the ball boy. And I just love that, just how gentle an expression he has, but just wise. So go ahead.
I am so amazed that you just said that, because that's my favorite picture too, by far. And I had an enormous number of photographs to choose from. I'm the son and grandson and great grandson of professional photographers. I'm the only one in my family who's not a professional photographer. But I love photographs, and I always work very hard on my books to get the best photographs possible. And of course, they can be very expensive. But I didn't care, because I really wanted that to add to it. And that particular photo, I had to fight for. Not all the editors at Simon & Schuster were convinced that that was a keeper. And I had to say, look, there's something about that picture. Arthur sitting next to that ball boy, and they both look like, I don't know, they're meditating. I don't know what they're doing, but I was saying the other day, someone else mentioned this, and I want to find that ball boy. I have no idea. It was 1965 in Dallas, at the WCT championships. I hope someone will email me.
Yes.
And let me know who that person was. I was so struck the other day when the New York Times review came out by Touré. And I had no idea, of course, that I've seen Touré on television for years, but I had no idea that he had this tennis connection, or that as a 7-year-old, as he says in the review, he was at the sports club in Dorchester, Massachusetts, when Arthur Ashe came to talk to those children, he says it changed his life. And I actually have that in the book about that particular visit, not knowing, of course, that one of those little kids would end up reviewing my book in the New York Times. But I've been getting so many emails from people talking about various connections with Ashe, and stories that, of course, I didn't know when I wrote it. And I know the book is long enough, and probably I don't need any more, can't take any more stories. But it's been really meant a lot to me for people to correspond with me. And I hope maybe that ball boy will turn up, because that is definitely my favorite picture in the whole book, among many, I think, very fine pictures.
Oh, there's some wonders. They're just, you know, you mentioned Kareem and as Lew Alcindor, you mentioned RFK. All of that just brings this man to life as a member of the world community and an impressive man. And Raymond Arsenault, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, the book is Arthur Ashe, A Life. We've enjoyed talking to you. I just want to encourage my audience to go out and get this book and read it. It is wonderful. It's perfect for the times. But Raymond Arsenault, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you as well.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
After the end credits, please stick around for the Arthur Ashe, A Life reading from actor Deshawn Terry, courtesy of Simon Schuster. Enjoy.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Arthur Ashe, A Life by Raymond Arsenault, read by Deshawn Kevin Terry. Preface. For the past 10 years, I have enjoyed playing doubles, just about every Sunday morning, on the soft courts of the St. Petersburg Tennis Center, where Arthur Ashe played his final match as an amateur in March 1969, the year I graduated from college. Playing under a high blue Florida sky with old friends, what more could one ask for, aside from a faster serve, a better backhand, and a little luck against left-handers? Of course, even Ashe had trouble against left-handers, especially his nemesis, the great Aussie Rod Laver. So, I shouldn't have been surprised in January 2016 when a crafty left-handed opponent hit a drop shot that caught me off guard, causing me to lunge awkwardly, lose my balance, and fall to the ground, breaking my left wrist in two places. Embarrassed, I joked with friends that my clumsiness proved, once and for all, that I was no Arthur Ashe. Clearly, there's only so much a biographer can learn from his subject. As my doubles partners will attest, immersing myself in all things Ashe has not improved my tennis game, and I still play with more enthusiasm than skill. On the other hand, I feel my continuing encounter with Arthur, it took me several years to reach the point where I felt comfortable referring to him on a first-name basis, has been immensely helpful in other parts of my life. Of all the historical characters I have studied during my long scholarly career, he comes the closest to being an exemplary role model. He wasn't perfect, as the chapters following will demonstrate, and he, like everyone else, was a flesh and blood human being limited by flaws and eccentricities. Yet, through a lifetime of challenges, large and small, he came remarkably close to living up to his professed ideals. As the first black man to reach the upper echelon of a notoriously elitist and racially segregated sport, Ashe exhibited an extraordinary strength of character that eventually made him the most beloved and honored figure in tennis. He was the Jackie Robinson of men's tennis. But unlike the great Brooklyn Dodger star, he was destined to soldier on alone throughout his playing career. On the men's tour of the 1960s and 1970s, there was no counterpart to Robinson's black peers. No Larry Doby, Willie Mays, or Hank Aaron. Though shy and generally reticent into his mid-20s, Ashe took a sharp turn toward activism in 1968 and never looked back. By the close of his career, he had become a model of cosmopolitanism and a self-proclaimed citizen of the world, earning almost universal respect as a forceful civil rights activist, an independent-minded thinker and writer, a humanitarian philanthropist, and an unrivaled ambassador of sportsmanship and fair play. More than any other athlete of the modern era, with the possible exception of Muhammad Ali, he transcended the world of sports. Arthur had a positive impact on virtually every part of the world he touched by adhering to a stringent code of personal ethics and uncommon generosity and empathy in his dealings with all who crossed his path, a passionate belief in the salvific power of education and intellectual inquiry, an extraordinary work ethic, and a deep commitment to social and civic responsibility. Add his zest for life and capacity for true friendship, and you have the full package of commendable personal traits. He did not live very long, dying 5 months short of his 50th birthday, but he jammed as much meaningful activity into his relatively brief lifetime as was humanly possible.